Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, my name is Danny Roth, and this is Everyday Horror. It's a podcast where we watch at least one horror movie for every day in the month of October, and then we talk about them. Today, I am joined by Joe Bandelli, who is the producer on the Hell House LLC movies. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Dan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing real good because we're going to talk about a movie that you selected. What is the movie?
The movie that I selected was none other than Paranormal Activity.
Oh, all right. So we're kind of going back to, I guess not like the very first found footage movie, because that's basically Blair Witch, but like certainly the one that sort of proved that it was really franchisable and sort of kicked off. I would say like, what is the modern day found footage oeuvre within horror?
I would agree with you. Yeah. And I have, I have some tidbits to talk about with found footage in general prior to that. But yeah, I would agree with you. Paranormal Activity is the one that did it for me. And I think the one that kind of changed the game a little bit for a lot of people.
Yeah. So why did you pick this particular movie? You do have a background in found footage now.
Yeah. So I am the producer of a little film called Hell House LLC, as well as the sequel, Hell House LLC 2, The Abaddon Hotel, which was just released on Shudder about 2 weeks ago. I've been a filmmaker for about 12, 13 years now, write, direct, produce. And, you know, I was always a horror fan. I'm a huge horror fan. I have a tattoo sleeve of horror characters. I'm obsessed with it. But found footage was never really my thing until filmmaker named Stephen Cognetti and I were introduced about 5 years ago. And he was the one who had the idea for Hell House LLC. And after that, I dove into the found footage world, and I just figure it's one of the genres that I think changes how horror films and how storytelling is. So I wanted to immerse myself in it and really make sure I understand it. And, you know, it seems like the fans of the Hell House franchise really love what we're doing. So it's just something that is making me feel like I'm a better producer, I'm a better filmmaker to really understand the full genre of that in an overcompassing horror world.
Paranormal Activity is a very unusual film in a number of ways. It does borrow one particular thing from Blair Witch, which I think is pretty rare now, which is that there wasn't really a script. The director basically said, here is the outline scene by scene. And then he went and they released, I think it was almost 2 years ago now, they released the footage showing them getting the two actors on board who were so tied to the roles that their names are just the names of the characters.
Yeah. Talk about acting, right?
Yeah. So it's pretty wild seeing that. But I guess just to sort of like give the backdrop, Paranormal Activity has a pretty basic story. There's two people. I think they're dating, not married at the time. It's Katie and Mika. Katie has always kind of had something in the back of her life, kind of basic hauntings, something, things that make her feel like supernatural stuff is real. Starts to kick up, and Mika's solution, is like, oh, I'll just film all of this in order to figure out what's going on. I'll crack the case with a camera and also maybe make some money in the process, because he's a day trader, and so everything he thinks about is sort of money related, and the result is that there is something, and by filming it, they're just pissing that thing off, and things go horribly awry. It's not terribly complicated. It's not a really in-depth plot, but the thing that really makes it striking, and what I remember being the conversation about it when it came out, was that because it was shot in a very basic way, because it wasn't really shot on super professional cameras, and because there was no script to speak of, really, everything felt hyper-realistic. So there wasn't really a need to rely upon special effects too much, because the ones that they did would go a really long way, because it really, it looks like something that like you could have, you know, found on a VHS tape and just watched someone's home movies.
Exactly.
And that yielded a pretty, like, the success of that movie is, I think at this point, unrivaled.
Yeah, I believe it is the most successful horror film in terms of financial of all time, and that's because of such a low budget that they made it for. I think they made it for about $7,000. It's either $7,000 or $15,000.
It's 15 grand, and they made, I think, just shy of $200 million worldwide, which is unbelievable. That's like, you know, nothing like that ever happens. You know what I mean? Like, Get Out made a lot of money, but Get Out cost, you know, millions to make. You know what I mean? Like, the people don't make movies that are that cheap. Even Blair Witch cost, I think, like $60,000 when it came out to make. And so it's pretty wild to think in those terms. Upon your rewatch, what sort of struck you about it?
Well, you know, I agree. You know, in general, there's been found footage films since, you know, the 60s and the 80s. But the first real found footage film that sort of resonated with audiences was Blair Witch in 1999. And I hated Blair Witch just because I felt dizzy. I felt like I was going to throw up. But I remember the marketing, and I remember not really knowing if those people, if something happened to those people. And I remember the director hid the people, the actors, so that you didn't know if it was real what happened. And I remember thinking about going into Paranormal Activity and thinking to myself, because I wasn't a huge found footage person at the time when it came out. And I remember thinking to myself, like, oh, this is going to be another Woods movie, another stupid, you know, someone's going to go out there and then they're going to try to hide the actors, like, blah, blah, blah. But I think the organic feeling of actually believing, if you believe in supernatural or if you believe in any type of ghosts or, you know, apparitions or any of that kind of stuff, I think this movie really toys with you and plays with that, because I think, you know, seeing organic performances and seeing just these two people and the low budget quality of how they're shooting made it feel very, very real. And I also feel like it was somewhat upped because it wasn't just shooting themselves in the woods. It was, you know, Mika's character was shooting and also in a way editing and showing footage and playback from every day, which I think was kind of one of the big differences, is showing, you know, hey, this happened last night, this happened last night. This is, you know, what we're going to try, a couple new things. And I think that for me is what changed it, is the not only the fact that these characters are playing with the cameras and doing everything on their own, so their performances were organic, but also the fact that they were aware that they were doing that and they were editing it and showing it as if, you know, it was like, it was very meta, if that makes sense. So that to me kind of changed it. And also technology. I think one of the big things that, you know, hopefully we'll dive into a little bit more is what's happened since that film is more found footage films have come out and even more narrative mainstream films have come out that kind of focus around the technology of what that film did. You know, Unfriended is a really good example of a horror film that's found footage and it's all using social media and computers. And I believe, you know, even not necessarily a horror film, but more of a suspense thriller, the movie Searching just came out a few months ago, and that movie's doing really, really well with John Cho. And that movie's all based on computers, social media, and all that stuff. And I feel like all of that is stemmed from Paranormal Activity.
Absolutely. I think what's really great about that first one, it's funny, when I watched it in theaters, I waited a minute before I saw it, and so I was impacted by the hype. I was way too cool for it. When I saw it the first time, I was like, whatever, I'm not going to be gotten by this thing. But I remember in the theater, people still seeing it weeks later and still being really freaked out about it. And then, pardon me, boy, I really should have gotten some water. And then watching it now, I am actually really sort of overwhelmed how with a decade about worth of hindsight, you can really see why it works. Because the thing about found footage is that I think the first question is always, how do you justify the fact that somebody is filming the thing? And they do a really good job of making Mika seem like obnoxious. Like, this is totally a thing this guy would do. It becomes instantly believable, and they also answer the other big question, which is why don't they just leave? And they do that pretty effectively by introducing an authority figure that says, well, it's got nothing to do with the house. It's got everything to do with the woman. So even if you leave, it'll just follow you. And so I think that between those two factors, they set up a very specific formula so that you're not constantly thinking about how this stretches belief, which is a problem that I think most found footage movies after have sort of run into.
Being that I was a person who never really enjoyed found footage and then got into it and started enjoying it, the number one thing that I think any person who doesn't like found footage films or isn't interested in it, the number one thing that makes someone uninterested in a found footage film, in my opinion, is why the hell would these people still be recording and still be filming when their death is potentially, you know, moments away, or their pending doom or something like that. And, you know, the joke that I've heard from cinematographers and people that I've worked with in the industry is like they turn into Fellini or Scorsese, and it's like, you can't put the camera down. And I think that's where you lose some of the general audience people, because they're like, wait a second, like, you're about to die. Why are you still holding that camera? And I think with Paranormal Activity, there was never that doom or you're going to die. There was freakish moments, but the person who held the camera 90% of the time was Mika. And throughout the entire film, there's not one moment where it feels like Mika's going to die. And I feel like that to me was a good thing to put into the story to make sure that you understood, like, this guy's going to keep recording because he's trying to help his girlfriend. He's trying to solve this problem for her. He's trying to figure these things out. They're weird. He's not really a believer. He's kind of a jokester. But you also notice that with her in the beginning, she's a little bit more playful with the camera. She's having fun with it. But once the stuff starts getting serious, she doesn't really touch the camera anymore. And to me, that was more believable because she actually does believe in this stuff, and she knows that there's been some type of entity kind of haunting her entire life. So for her, it is real. And of course, if her life is on the line, she's not going to touch anything. So that to me resonated a lot.
Yeah. And they also, I don't know at what point they realized this was going to be such a smart thing to do, but for the most part, he's not handycamming. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's almost always got it on a tripod. And that sort of it's got a twofold benefit. One, you're not dealing with the Blair Witch issue of constantly feeling nauseous because there's all this running around with the camera all the time. And two, when things are happening that are really harrowing, they're all in one particular room location where they are either trapped or whatever. And he's not automatically every time grabbing that camera and lugging it around as things are in danger. It just so happens that camera is sitting in that corner of the room.
Exactly. And I think that's why, for me, this movie kind of changed the game, because it became one of the, you don't just have to have a person have a handy cam and hold the camera. That's not the only found footage technique. There's multiple other techniques, putting it on tripods, security cameras, multiple cameras. And you see that in, as found footage has become more and more popular since Paranormal Activity has come out.
So what I did was, when I said I'll sit and watch Paranormal Activity, I thought, well, there's six of these. I do not want to, you know, with respect to the Paranormal Activity franchise, I did not want to watch all six. That was not on my to-do list. I am watching at least 31 horror movies this month, and it's a lot to say, like, you know, I'll just watch this whole darn franchise, you know? I like Hellraiser, too. I'm not watching every single Hellraiser movie. That just, you know, that ain't happening. I'm not doing that with any franchise this month. But I thought it would be smart to look at the first and then look at the last attempt that they made to sort of see what kind of journey they went on and why it is that things work a little less well. And the reason, so like the last one that came out is actually, I mean, like somewhat recent. It came out in 2015. It's called Paranormal Activity, The Ghost Dimension. And the thing about it that makes you immediately know that it's just not going to be even remotely the same is that they promoted it as being like, this time you see everything. And I was like, well, that's the whole point, is that you see nothing. That's literally the whole point of the ideas, is that you see so little. And in fact, you can see that this is heavily polished, that there's a lot of scripting to it, that their excuse The reason why people are carrying a camera around the whole time is that the camera they find inside of this house is it's a magic camera. It's got special properties. You can see stuff with this camera that you can't see, it's a hat on a hat on a hat is what happens, is they keep having to add justification. So like the justification of the camera is that. And then the other thing is, well, you know, we've got to find a way to tie in the story of the two sisters, right? Because that's sort of where that franchise went originally, is that, you know, you've got the one, you've got Katie and the first one, and then her sister, Katie is one and Christy is the other. There we go. Katie and Christy. I definitely got that right the first time. They were haunted as kids. Something happened. Their house burned down. And the movies start to explore the idea of who they are. So the second movie is set like right before Paranormal Activity, the OG. And then the third one is like a way prequel. And eventually you just get to a point where like there's like a witch cult trying to bring a demon into the world as a full flesh being. And that, and by the time we get to the sixth film, this is the one where they finally succeed. Spoilers. And it's just so much. It's so far to go from Christie's was haunted since she was a little kid and we don't know why, to cult magic camera.
It's the same problem that every single franchise has, more specifically every single horror franchise has, is, you know, I don't even know why I do this, but there's certain things within a character that you will, like Halloween, for instance. I'll see every single Halloween movie that they ever make. If Michael Myers is in it, I'm going to see it. Do I think they're all good? No, but I will see every single one, and that's usually how horror films make so much money. Like, you have creative first films, the 1978 Halloween, Saw when it came out, Nightmare on Elm Street when it came out. But by the time you get to the seventh, eighth, ninth ones of those, they're raking in money because you have people who are just going to be like, well, I like the character and the character's so iconic or the story's so original that I kind of just want to see what happens. And that's how they're making money off of it. And then this is going to a bigger picture, but goes into the whole aspect of filmmaking, which is, what is the studio going to bank on? A film that has a following already that they know they're going to make money on, or something completely original that we've never seen before that may fail. And that's why we have 10 movies in a franchise or 8 movies in a franchise, because it happens to every single franchise. But I mean, yeah, when you're doing a found footage film, you have a very, very low budget. You have to be creative. You are forced to be creative. And that's what Paranormal Activity and Warren Pelley did, was he was very creative with his shot choices, with what he was letting Mika and Katie do, with the special effects and the visual effects that he used. He was very, very selective, and it was very minimal. Whereas by the time they get to the fifth movie or the sixth movie, they have a $30 million budget. So instead of being creative and figuring out the best way to scare someone, it's let's just throw money at all of those things. And whatever, we have a fan base. They're just going to follow it, and they're just going to accept it and suspend their disbelief. And as you so eloquently put, it just doesn't work.
They were pretty smart for a while because, you know, it was, I mean, it's a leap, right? Because the original Paranormal Activity, $15,000. But they, I mean, relatively speaking, Paranormal 2 was a $3 million budget. Paranormal 3 was $5 million, same for 4, same for 5. And it wasn't until 6 that they were like, now we'll spend $10 million. And that's the one that tanked. Really, technically speaking, if you look at all the previous ones, they did fine, especially 3, which I think did just about as well as the first one did, because, you know, they were, it's interesting that people were at that time willing to go on a journey to find out sort of the origin of the two sisters. But like, once you get past that, it's just, I think there's a limit to how far you can stretch those two sisters. They're not really, like, I don't look at them and go, man, those are two great slasher queens. Like, I don't think that's the strength of the film. Like, yes, the characters serve a good purpose, and it's more the relationship in the first movie to the two, you know, like one who is antagonistic and very skeptical, and the other one who is just trying to get by and is a real believer. And, you know, it's that Mulder and Scully kind of thing, you know, like that is a tried and true, thoroughly, almost always successful dynamic. and they've got that. But I don't, you know, I don't think that I would be like, man, let me watch these two characters for six movies. I don't know.
I mean, but also think about why these movies get made in the first place. When a first film is getting made and when the original was getting made, like Oren Peli was trying to tell a story. If I had to guess, sure, he might have had ideas of maybe a second movie or a third movie, but the original Paranormal Activity came out of he wanted to tell Katie and Mika's story. Obviously, it wasn't originally Katie and Mika. It was two characters, boyfriend and girlfriend. He wanted to tell their story, and he had a specific way of how to do it, and that's how the original, you know, film got made. But when the second, third, and even the sixth one got made, it wasn't how do we tell a creative and interesting story? It's now, this has made money. What can we do to add to the story? How can we change things? And that's where you lose things. And that's where it starts getting bad and where things start flopping, because it's not about telling a unique and individual story anymore. It's about, let's see what we can add on to this and let's see what we can change and make better with money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anytime that you've taken a movie to a point where you're like, let's just, you know, let's have them travel in time.
And most filmmakers will tell you, like, if a lot of people will say, well, what do you want to make? 2, 3, 4 of those things? And they'll say, I just want to make one good one. Like, I just want to make a really good movie and we'll figure out the rest later.
So as a point of contrast, what was the situation with Hell House LLC? Was the intention just to make one good one at the time?
This one's an interesting one. So Stephen Cognetti, the writer and director of it, his idea was always to do a trilogy. He always wanted to do three. We actually spoke about it plenty of times in the earlier phases of shooting the first one, because he kept saying he wanted to do certain things so that when the second and third, and I kept saying, make this one good. And so we would kind of joke about that a lot, because it's like, let's get one, because if one fails, you're never going to make a second or a third. So let's get, and you know, to his credit, his ideas for what he wanted to do with a second and third, I think made perfect sense. And for anyone who has seen the second film's good. I think the first film has questions, but they're more of a, wow, that's creepy. And I really want to understand like how this came about. The second film has questions, but it's more questions like, I can't wait to see the third one because I know those questions are going to be answered. So, you know, he designed it so that the second film was sort of like and I'm by no means comparing it to this movie, but like an Empire Strikes Back, where you know that there are things that are going to be answered in the third one. So you have to kind of leave them open-ended in the second.
It's just like Empire. Just as good. Definitely of the same quality. I don't want to get like too far off track, but yeah, I mean, like, I don't, when people hear that like found footage movie franchise, most people don't go, man, that's going to be great. Second one out the gate, going to be as good as the first. Not really a traditional thing, but the reaction to that second movie was wild. Like insane. I genuinely, because I, you know, like Hell House LLC was kind of in the background for me until the second one was this sort of like, it was a bit of a surprise announcement as I recall, right? Where it was like, surprise, it's dropping like this week. And everybody flipped out, and I said, "What? What's this?" And then watched the first one, and then immediately watched the second one, and then looked at social media as people saw all sort of seemed to agree that the second one was at least as good as the first, and that I think that's such a rare, you don't really hear that much. That's not a thing that happens.
And you know the thing, we knew that. You know, when you make a second film, your critics are going to be much harsher. So obviously there are definitely some good things said about it. There's also some bad things said about it. But I think in general, I think the theme of what we're trying to work with is still working. And, you know, the first film is very much found footage, mockumentary type style. And it follows, a documentary journalist trying to figure out what happened to these five people. And then the second film is a little bit different in the style that it's intercut between a live television, like a morning news television show, with found footage of what took place. So it's, and it introduces a character in the very, very opening of the first lines of the film. It introduces a character who we never talk about again, which is clearly a setup for the third film.
So yeah, talk about the filmmaking of found footage, because you've now done multiple ones. How do you make one effectively in your mind?
Sure. So I think, you know, I think to Steve's credit, one of the best things to do is find a location and find a space that works. So Steve wrote the entire script based on the house that he found. I know he spent a lot of time before him and I even got introduced. He spent a lot of time scouting and going to haunted houses and looking to see what the right fit was. So when he found the house that we were going to use, he wrote the script and kind of geared it towards it. But as you mentioned earlier, kind of with the Blair Witch and the Paranormal Activity, he had a lot of, especially for the first one, for the original film, he had a lot of, he wrote a lot of dialogue, but he went into it with all of the actors saying, the dialogue isn't important, just get from point A to point B. And what we found was when we had the cast came together. It was like these people were best friends and it came across on camera. Like we had them living together. We had them spending time together. Like they were with one another the entire time. After we got done shooting, everyone was going out, having fun, hanging out, going to the bar. So these people kind of felt like family. And I think once we gave them the camera and we started going through what they were doing, not only did we get a lot of improv that really worked well, but we also got a lot of scenes that we were just in the middle of doing things. And we're like, wait a second, let's do this. Let's pick that up. Let's shoot this here. This is going to be really creepy. So I think the foundation is finding a location and getting a really good cast. I think, you know, if you don't find a cast that can improv well, you're going to kind of struggle. If you find someone who's, I can only do the words in the page, it's not really going to work. But Steve did a really good job with the script. And, you know, there are some people who write who are like, nope, I need it to be the words that are in the script. Steve was not like that at all. He was like, this is an outline. This is a plan. Let's you guys take it from A to B and we'll see how it plays out. And like I said, it came out fantastic. Like, you know, the other difference from the side of the filmmaking side is found footage is shot in a much quicker time frame. So usually, you know, a narrative styled horror feature film would probably take 30 to 60 days to shoot. I believe we shot the first Hell House in 10 days and then we shot the second one in 8 days. So it's a much quicker timeline.
Yeah. I gotta say, I mean, this is one way in which, I find that, it's good. Found footage, it really comes in handy because, you know, I'll say this, shooting in one location, a lot of filmmakers do it. I always think of Dave Dakota, who, you know, makes like a talking cat and stuff like that in his house. And he is, you know, a real student of Roger Corman and makes these things where, you know, someone will say, all right, someone's got a house. They've cleared out of it and no one's moving into it for a week. So you've got like eventually somebody's going to come in and do whatever, blah, blah, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got 5 days. Can you make a movie in 5 days? And then he would do it. But like it's very tricky to thoroughly script a thing and find all of that stuff in a way that is going to look so professional that looks like, you know, like this wasn't shot by a person holding a camera who could potentially be a character themselves. Like it's very hard to do that. I think, I mean, not that there are no good ones. That movie I was mentioning, is called Nightmare Sisters and it's ridiculous. And I highly recommend it to anybody who likes like weird schlocky old, like blood and titties 80s movies. It's very entertaining, but yeah, I mean like, found footage, it's just that, like, the trick is you can't say it and then be like, cool, so I can be lazy. Like, that's not it. It's that it services a very specific constraint, and then you have to find the best parts through that constraint.
Exactly. And I would say it's probably, I don't want to oversimplify this and say this, but usually, like, if you're doing reality television is shoot as much as you can, and then it's really on the editors and the producers to kind of craft the story in post-production. It's not like that with found footage, but you have an element of that where it's shoot a lot of stuff, get a lot of things in, and we'll figure it out. Because I will say that one of the benefits to doing found footage is it's not that it's laziness, but your audience is much more forgiving of things in found footage than they would be in a narrative. Like if something doesn't match from shot to shot, in a found footage film, it's easy to disguise that. if something doesn't match in a narrative film, it's very, very obvious and it'll immediately pull your audience out of it.
There's almost something like of the David Mamet to found footage, because you know, people have a tendency to like, they'll fumble a little bit with a line, they'll talk over each other, but that, because again, it's found footage, it can work. It can end up adding to the realism, because that is the way that people talk. I mean, we've been talking over each other throughout this podcast. That's how people speak. And so it's one of the potential strengths if you do it right.
I was going to say, the only other thing that I would say that really popped out to me with found footage is finding the moments to have the right scares. Because in a narrative horror film, you have a scare, you have something in the background, you have a jumpy moment, and you have a score that supports that. In found footage films, you usually don't put in the score to support that, because then it's very obvious that it's not a found footage film. You know, if you have this, you know, crescendo of audio coming in when a character jumps from the background, it kind of takes away the natural realism or the organic part of it being found footage. But it's really interesting, because one of the things that Steve had paid so much attention, and we worked so hard on making sure we had some of those moments, is I guarantee you, you know, if you haven't seen Hell House a dozen times, I guarantee you, if you watch that movie over and over, you're going to notice things in the background and things that are really, really creepy, that in a narrative film, we would point our fingers at it and say, look at this thing. Where in a found footage film, you don't do that. It's more of the, and that's what makes people creeped out. And that's what makes people scared, is when they go back and watch it, they're like, holy shit, this is here. And I never noticed it, but no one's telling me I have to look at this. It's just another little tidbit to pick up on.
I had never even thought about that, but that totally tracks for me. I think that to bring it back to Paranormal Activity, just quick, because you were talking about figuring out where the scares go. It's the same thing, right? Like the mentality was few and far between, because there are all these little things that like keep you entertained. I think even Roger Ebert said, you know, like you'll never be bored, even though it seems like you should be. Because they are so choosy with the moments they pick, and the increased sort of danger that they're in, because it does take time to sort of get there, and it's spooky to have, you know, just a door move a little bit before it slams, and to have your character just stand silently for, you know, X number of hours before you get to the part where they're, you know, genuinely possessed. And all of those things slowly sort of increase the story in a way that, I mean, like, I guess a traditional narrative does that to a degree too, but it's so sparing, and that's what makes it work.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, that, and, you know, in film, in any, even in theater, story is always the most important thing. And I think what that also does is it's about the story. Like, this demon doesn't have the ability to possess them until it's grown powerful, until it has the ability to scare them and terrify them. And in the beginning, it's not powerful. So the things that it could do to them is so subtle and so insignificant. But once they start picking up on it, once they start getting weirded out by that, their fear starts to grow. Then this demon starts to get more powerful. Then it could start slamming doors and it could start pulling them out of beds. And it works perfectly for the story.
One other thing that I wanted to sort of quickly draw attention to is, Steven Spielberg was involved with this movie at the very end. That's crazy. I can't believe that. That blows my mind. That and I had completely forgotten until I was rewatching and then re-researching it, was that, you know, they'd had a different ending when it first started making the rounds in 2007. And by the time it came out proper in 2009, the ending was a Spielberg ending, apparently, which is wild. I mean, how often does that happen? And I wonder, like, maybe I'm incorrect, but I gotta say, knowing what the other endings were, I still think this movie would have been really successful. No shade on Spielberg, but I don't think that ending was so much better.
I just think that with the Spielberg ending, and then the other one, that they had another ending that they did show in theaters, because they showed two endings, the one that's currently out, and the can I say it? Is it cool if I ruin this?
Yeah, I think you're probably fine. Yeah, the movie's been out for a decade. Yeah, you're safe.
Okay, the ending where they throw the body at the camera, which is currently the final ending, and then the ending where she slits her throat. Both of those are the ones that they actually showed when the movie got to theaters. But the theater that was more the Spielberg one was when the police show up and the police shoot them. And I think that one, I think both that one and The Slit Throat, the reason why they didn't go in those directions were because then you, the characters are all dead. And again, going back to what we were talking about before, when Oren Peli created this film, like, I think his thing was to make a really good horror film that's found footage. So for him, if the characters died at the end, it didn't matter. You know what I mean? It'd be creepy. It'd be, you know, weird. But once the movie making, or the, I'm sorry, the money making side of it came in, it's like, we need to have some type of thing to leave it on an open-ended note. And I think that's where, that's why they decided to go with the ending that they had.
Yeah. I mean, it works and it does. It was the reason that ultimately they could go on and make sequel after sequel after sequel. But it's just, it's wild. But y'all didn't need any Steven Spielberg to tell you to sort of leave things pseudo open.
There's two people that are actually very interesting about that. Obviously, Steven Spielberg was the one that got it, you know, the budget that eventually, you know, the film that we watch now, when we watch it on Amazon Prime or when we saw it in theaters, that film was not the $15,000 film. Like, that movie had a lot of audio re-recording, a lot of things done in that. But the all of that came from Spielberg. But one thing that a lot of people forget about is this was one of the first films that Jason Blum took on his own before he started Blumhouse. I believe he was an executive at Miramax when he found this, and he was the one who worked with Oren Peli to make some changes to it before it even got to Steven Spielberg. So I think, you know, in general, it's funny to see, you know, how people get started. And obviously Jason Blum had a career before then, but this was kind of the kickoff of Blumhouse. I think, you know, for us, you know, when you say we didn't need a Spielberg, I guarantee you if we had a Spielberg, this Hell House franchise would be a lot bigger than what it is. And it's already pretty decent size, but you still kind of need someone to get it from, you know, I would say it's grown tremendously in the fact that we never thought we would get the amount of viewers that we had now. Okay, let me rephrase. Steve always thought that. Steve always believed in it. I always believed in Steve, but I'm a pessimist by nature. I always feel like once you get done with it, you hope for the best and assume the worst. And when we got such a great reaction to it, I was pleasantly surprised and very excited about it. But you never think that, you know, I think to play in the realism world, you never think that your film's going to be seen by 10 people or 100 people or 1,000 people or 100,000 people. So the more attention this got, the greater it was. But if we had a Spielberg or if we had someone like that, this would be seen by millions of people. And, you know, one of the really good, cool things for us, especially tying it back to Paranormal Activity, was when Hell House came out, I believe Jason Blum wrote something about it saying that it was one of the five best found footage films he's seen in the last 10 years. Which obviously was really great for us to hear.
Yeah, I mean, that is, in a way, it is almost like having a Spielberg, just having somebody say that. Yeah, it's like no small shake. And I had not even, I had forgotten that that Blumhouse might not be Blumhouse if not for Paranormal Activity, which is for found footage, which I, you know, among horror dweebs, it is often the most mocked, the most decried as not being worth it, not true filmmaking. Like, you know, people get very, very up in arms about, you know, what counts and what doesn't. And found footage is always the one that takes the most shit. And like, if it weren't for Paranormal Activity, just think how many movies of many horror subgenres would maybe never have existed or never have been so accessible, because like Blumhouse being successful as it is also, I think, in part of why A24 is so successful and why a lot of other companies have been able to make movies of this type, and why every kind of horror, including art house horror, is as big as it is now. Like, it's weird to think that that much could potentially rest on the shoulders of Paranormal Activity, but I think it kind of does.
I mean, and even think about Blumhouse's, the entire company's method of making horror films. Like, they're very well known for making horror films that are under $5 million and on micro budgets, and they gross $200, $300, $500 million. And that idea sparked from Paranormal Activity.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks, Paranormal Activity. You basically are the reason that horror is the way that it is right now, kind of. Well, let's make a recommendation. So let's say somebody listens to this podcast and thinks, you know, yeah, I do like that Paranormal Activity. What else would I want to watch after watching that? What would you recommend?
So this is always hard because, like I said, found footage is really hard to make well, but I would say VHS is probably the one that people should see. There's been a few VHSs. Have you seen them?
I have.
Okay. So I would recommend VHS. It kind of, you know, it does the whole like short film within an anthology and have a bigger film to tie it all in. So there are a couple of them that are really, really good and really creepy. And there's a couple that are not, but I think that's a, for someone who doesn't have a big, found footage following, I think that's a really good entranceway into found footage. I mean, if I would have watched VHS first, it probably would have helped me get into found footage much earlier than I did.
Anything that's got multiple stories within the story is going to have chapters that are stronger than others. But I would say pretty consistently, most of the VHS stuff is really solid. So, yeah, I totally agree. That is a thing to check out. And then
I'd also plug Unfriended. I know true horror fans are going to tell me to, you know, F off on that one. But I think that, you know, I'm mesmerized by what people can do with technology. And I think the social media and computer aspect of making something creepy, I was blown away by that. Like, sure, it might have been a simple story, but I just thought that the way they use technology to tell a story was very interesting.
Oh, I completely agree. It's funny to me that so many people are down on that. I'm really blown away by that one. But what was I going to say? I also would say, it would be weird if you said it, so I'll say it. People should definitely check out Hell House LLC and the sequel. They are, in fact, really good found footage movies that I think, once again, are kind of finding interesting ways to sort of plumb the depths of what you can do with that genre. And also, I would say Scott Weinberg, who is a pretty well-known horror critic, was one of the co-producers on a movie called Found Footage 3D, which is super meta, has a really good comedy edge to it, but is, again, really, it's very smart in the way that it uses the concept and the trappings of found footage. And it's got a couple of scares, but also I think it's got a really great sense of humor to it and some really great performers. So that would be my other recommendation. So now people have got so many choices.
I would say there's one other thing, and this is more for just true people that want to follow the art of found footage and figure out like where it stemmed from. What's considered one of, if not the original actual found footage film, is Cannibal Holocaust in 1980. Have you ever seen that?
I have.
Okay, so that movie's awful. And the whole movie is not found footage, but there's pieces of it that are. And that was one of the first films that actually showcased that. The only reason why I'm saying that, you know, true people who want to understand the history should watch it is because not only did that film kind of start found footage, but it also was one of the first films to talk about the Green Inferno, which is where Eli Roth got the inspiration to make the movie Green Inferno. So if you're an Eli Roth fan, that movie is kind of like the Bible of how that movie got made.
Yeah, totally. That is fair. Yeah. I mean, I recommend lots of movies that I have to say, I don't know if it's actually good, but there is something sort of historically interesting, or there are elements, you know. A lot of things are less than the sum of their parts, but are still pretty worthwhile. Anyway, that is our episode. Joe, where can people find you online?
Sure. So I am on Instagram, I'm Twitter, all of those things. My handle on everything is The Chosen Joey. Pretty simple. And then my website is, it's my name, it's www.joebandelli.com. And I would say everyone, I appreciate being here. This was awesome, Dan. And thanks for talking about Hell House a little bit. I hope people love it. Hell House is available on, Hell House 2 is available on Shudder exclusively now until January. And then it'll be available on iTunes, Amazon Prime, as well as Shudder. And Hell House 1 is on all of those right now.
Yeah. And also shout out to Shudder. I mean, if you don't have a Shudder subscription and you're a horror fan, it is absolutely 100% worth the money. It's a great, great, great platform. My name is Danny Roth. You can find many other episodes of this podcast and the whole Sci-Fi Wire podcast family and all of our video content at sci-fi.com, along with some articles too, you know, if you feel like reading. But you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary also with one N. Thank you for listening, and remember, sometimes the best cure for the horrors of every day is a little everyday horror. We'll see you next time.